Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Living Well with Kathleen Saunders, your weekly podcast where we discuss the financial, physical, spiritual, and social well-being of everyday people like you and me. The information shared in this show is for general information purposes only and should not be used to make any personal changes to your lifestyle or health without consulting the appropriate financial, medical, or healthcare professionals. My guest today is Arlene Gurez. Arlene is a registered clinical counselor with over 30 years of working with children and families. She specializes in couples and family counseling, addictions, racial issues, and parenting challenges. Arlene also presents the following workshops: Freedom Through Forgiveness, The Joy of Loving Relationships, and Living a Life You Love. She is available to work both online and in person. For more information about these workshops or counseling sessions with Arlene, go to www.arlenegurez.com or on Facebook at Awakening the Spirit Within. Well, hello, Arlene, and thank you for being my guest today.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
I'm doing just fine. Very much looking forward to hearing you share about your article, The 7 Steps to End Racism. I know that the death of George Foreman and the Black Lives Matter has been a huge topic in the news lately, but tell me, what was it that led you to write this article?
Well, I have certainly followed Black Lives Matter for the last couple of years, and it's something that I care very much about, but I realized, well, let me backtrack a little bit. I belong to an online women's group, a Facebook group that is composed of several thousand women, like something like 30,000 women.
Oh, wow.
around the world, and it's run through Marie Forleo. So when George Foreman was killed, now I don't follow the news. Mm-hmm. I'm one of these people that I'm in my own little world. I live a spiritual life, and I just don't believe in being dragged down by negativity. So if there's something important going on in the world, my husband usually tells me he doesn't have an issue, and he likes following the news. So,
okay.
he had told me about what had happened, and he had watched the video, but that was as much as I knew about it. And then when I checked my Facebook group, it was just electric because Marie Forleo, who moderates the group, or she actually has a team of people that moderate it, had tried to shut down the conversations from the Black women who were struggling, of course, and they were traumatized once more by the death of George Foreman. So Marie had shut it down, but when she stopped to think about what the significance of what had happened and the significance of her as a white woman shutting the voices down, she opened it up. And once she opened it up, oh, I can hardly talk about this without the tears coming to my eyes. Wow. When she opened it up, the Black women who spoke with such strong emotion, and it was colorful. Mm-hmm. The language was colorful. There were no holds barred, and they said it just like it was for them. And I felt like for the first time I got it, and it was very, very different from just watching something on somebody else's Facebook. My information that had come regarding Black Lives Matter had come through my white American friends who were following the movement and trying to do their little piece to make a difference. But when we get this very visceral, heart-wrenching response to first the killing of George Foreman, and then secondly, the voices being shut down, it was very, very powerful for me. And this is actually my second article. My first article was about racism in Canada, because we are kidding ourselves as Canadians if we think that this is an American problem. The 7 ways to end with racism, mm-hmm, was really as a result of me, after a couple of weeks of doing intensive listening to all of these different voices that were on this Facebook page, doing some research, reading articles, starting to read some of the books that were recommended, and I just felt that it was really important to share, you know, because it's very easy to care, mm-hmm. and then that's as far as it goes.
True.
But what do we actually do about it? And that's where I had been for the last couple of years of following Black Lives Matter. I care about it, but I don't know what to do. So I thought, well, maybe there are other people out there are feeling the same mm-hmm, way, right. but really don't know what to do about it.
Okay. And so that's where this article came into place. So share with us. Tell us about the 7 steps that you wrote about.
All right. So I'll just give a quick overview.
Sure.
And then maybe we can talk about each step one by one.
Sounds good.
Step one is recognize. Now, I need to say that I feel very humbled because I know, Kathleen, that you are a woman of color and I'm brand new at this. I feel somewhat, it feels somewhat awkward because this is not going to be news to you. So please, just accept my feeling of humility around this. It's just like I'm just starting. It's like the scales have come off of my eyes and I am just starting down this road. So I don't want to misrepresent myself.
And you know, no problem. And Arlene, it's the best thing about it is that you're starting. You're not just looking
yeah.
on, you're doing something about it and you're starting. So, you know,
yeah.
that's a great thing.
Well, thank you. So step one is recognizing that the color of our body makes a difference to our lived experience. So it's very easy as a white person to just say, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't get it. But my learning has been that the trauma has generational trauma, which is another area that I have studied, is very much a big deal for people of color. And particularly for the descendants of the slaves in America. Step two is to avoid the spiritual bypass. So for those of us that are walking a spiritual path, it can sometimes be, well, you know, if people just prayed or if I just pray hard enough, then this problem will be taken care of and we'll all be good. And I mean, that's, you know, I finished my article by saying we can't put lipstick on a pig because it's actually very, I think it's in, this is my opinion, it's an offensive thing to have that attitude towards someone who has suffered for whatever reason. Step three is, and this was the hardest one for me, this did not really come for me, this came from a woman called Freedom Cartwright, who is an American. And we were having, as part of this business women's group, we had several different online meetings talking about the issue and so on. And I had relayed a story to her about a friend of mine who is cleaning houses, was very concerned because she has this woman that she loves. This woman is in her 80s. And they have, you know, she feels that the woman needs the company more than she needs her house cleaned. So she has her there a couple of times a week. And it's a lovely time for both people. But this 80-year-old woman has a black doll in her bedroom and has it sitting in a chair. And she's had that doll since she was a child. So, you know, we're talking about 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. The language around race was very, very different.
Yes.
And she said to my friend, how do you like my nigger baby?
What?
And my friend, well, I know, it's quite shocking in this day and age, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was, so my friend asked me, you know, how do I handle this? And my first response to her was that she needs to take a stand and tell this woman that's not appropriate. And if she's going to talk that way, then she won't be able to work for her anymore. But I could tell it wasn't sitting right with my friend. And so when I asked Freedom the question, she gave such and Freedom is a black woman. And again, this just moves me to tears to think of the love that this woman has in her heart, because she said, it is our call to be loving towards all people.
Yes.
And so perhaps your friend could ask her more questions about that. And she said, we always frame our answers. And first of all, we have to get our hearts right towards that person. If we're coming from a place of judgment or a place of anger, then it's going to come across that way. But if we're coming from a place of love, then the person will be much more likely to be able to hear us. And she suggested that, first of all, my friend pray on it. And then secondly, that she approach the woman and say, you know, can we talk a little bit more about this? And tell me a little bit more about your feelings around your doll. And that doll must be very precious to you. You've had it since you were a child. And you learned as a child how to talk. But and I have changed over the years as I've learned that it's no longer acceptable to use those kinds of words. And they are hurtful to people, even if they're not there to hear it. They're still very hurtful words. And then don't make a decision, you know, regardless of what your friend's response, because you might be able to do more by staying in that relationship.
Very true. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was so much more. I was just so impressed with Freedom's answer to that question, because this was in the thick of all the upset when so many people were just really, really, really angry and really hurt. Mm-hmm. And Freedom had the ability and the calmness, the clarity to be able to see through the quagmire to the place of love. You know, and we're all called to that.
Yes.
We're all called to that. So, as I said, that's the hardest part for me, but I'm working on it.
Good for you. One step at a time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Step four, look where...
But hold on,
Arlene.
I'm interested to know what ended up with that conversation. How did that go with your cleaner friend?
Well, I said, oh my gosh, I better call her right away, because I didn't want her to go and take a strong stand. This is the self-righteousness. That's a habitual kind of response for me, and I don't think it's helpful. So, so she had said that she was really grateful that I had asked the question, and that felt much better to her.
Good.
Than going in there on a campaign and trying to defend. That's exactly right. Yeah. So step four, look at where I have inadvertently supported racism by not getting involved. And we'll come back to these points. Step five, stand up and speak out. And again, there's lots that I would like to say about that and things that I've very recently learned. Step six, support businesses owned by people of color. And step seven, create greater opportunities for people of color. So let's go back to the beginning.
All right.
Okay, so for step one, recognize that the color of our body makes a difference to our lived experience. Well, of course, we would have to be truly colorblind to not recognize and not see color. And one of the conversations that people have been having, both in this Facebook group and in some different spiritual communities that I'm involved in, is the idea that I don't see color. Now, I don't know that I ever would have actually said that, because it wouldn't have been true.
Right.
But I would say I try not to see color. I try to, you know, in my mind, if anything, and this is a whole other area, I would go out of my way to be extra kind to someone who is of color, because I recognize that people have been abused, and I want to make up for that in some way. So, you know, I'm trying to, within myself, work this out, and I'm learning that people of color want to be seen. They want to be recognized, because of course we're all God's children, and we're all the same underneath our skin. And in fact, I heard a talk by an indigenous person. Now there's an interesting piece, a little stumble for me, because trying to remember the right terminology so that I'm not offending anyone is one of the challenges.
I bet.
And, so an Indigenous American man was giving a talk one time on love, and his statement was that these are just skin suits that we're wearing, and underneath we're all the same. And I kind of like that, but that also plays into the whole role of I don't see color, because we don't want to. You know, I'm a therapist, so I work with people who have trauma, and trauma is one of the areas that I specialize in. Mm-hmm. So for me to pretend when I'm dealing with someone that has experienced severe childhood trauma, they would need to be treated in a different way than someone who has not. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear you. I want to go back to something you had said, though. You wanted to treat the person differently. Make them feel appreciated, I think it was that you said. But I just wanted to know why. You wanted to recognize that person, but we want to be recognized, but we also want to just be treated equally. So yes, I'm different from you, different in color, but you know, that, and I think to me, that's just, and different cultures, obviously. But at the same time, I don't want you to treat me differently just because of the color of my skin. We realize that we're different colors, but treat me equally. I don't want there to be any special treatment because I'm a woman of color or Indigenous. Just the same way that you would treat a Caucasian person, treat me the same. No favoritism. That's what I just wanted to add in response to what you had said earlier.
Yes, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'm learning. It's something within me that wants to do that. Part of my nature is I care so much about people that have been hurt that, you know, however somebody has been hurt, I'm drawn to somehow make a positive difference in their lives. So for example, I was a school principal for many years before I retired from that and then became a counselor. And okay. I was always drawn to the children who, you know, they'd had a hard time in life. You could just tell.
Right.
And I very, very much wanted to be a positive person in their lives. So that's part of how I am. And I am learning exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the process mm-hmm. of how that is going to work for me.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I live in White Rock, which is a beautiful beach community, and I walk every day with my dog. Uh-huh. And part of that walk is when I pray before I go out that I can be a blessing to everyone that I meet, that God's love will shine through me.
Amen.
And so I am who I am with all people.
Awesome. That's
and,
good.
And so part of that is making sure that I don't miss on people from different cultures.
Okay.
So, which is kind of fun because some people of all different backgrounds are quite surprised when you greet them, when you say good morning to them. And it seems to me mm-hmm. that it is our Indo-Canadian population that are the most surprised. I think that's probably step one. You know, what I wrote here is, because I think this is important, I just want to read a little bit of what I wrote.
Sure.
Those of us who inhabit white bodies enjoy a variety of advantages, opportunities, and safety that black bodies simply do not have. Add on to that the generational trauma that those in black bodies experience. Consider what it means that your ancestors were slaves. Breathe this reality in. Feel the huge disparity in our backgrounds and experiences. And to me, that just thinking about that is very, very powerful. How can we not recognize that? And how can we say that, you know, just pull yourselves up by the bootstraps kind of thinking? I mean, it doesn't really fit, as I said earlier, for someone who has experienced trauma. And so I think in all cases, we want to treat each other with love, with gentleness, with kindness, and with consideration. You know, yeah. of what their background and their experience might have been.
Mm-hmm. I'm silent because I'm doing exactly what you're saying. Breathe it in, and I'm trying to, in my mind, think. It's easier said to, it's difficult for you as a Caucasian person. You understand, you hear what went through, but to truly understand, unless you walked in our shoes, to really understand what it was. And it's, we've inherited the oppression from our ancestors, and we all feel it daily. And so our attitude towards things come with that baggage. I mean, but we don't dwell on that. We push past that. And this is what we'd like Caucasians and everyone else out there is acknowledging, that this has happened and this was what's going on. But we need to find steps to get beyond.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that is what trauma work is about, is we receive this into ourselves. We acknowledge that this has happened, whether the trauma was our trauma that happened directly to us,
yes,
or the trauma of our ancestors. And there are so many studies now that are showing the impact of generational trauma. And when we recognize it, then we can heal it. But we cannot pretend it didn't happen.
Right, exactly.
And there's one more piece to this that I didn't include in the article, but if I was to rewrite the article, I would, is as a white person, just hearing what you just said, I need to be, first of all, listening is the most important thing that I can do.
Right.
So thank you, Kathleen, for just opening up in that way.
You're welcome.
To me and to your listeners. And the second part is, we can very easily say, yes, I had something like that happen to me too. And we as white people need to be so careful to not do that. That is, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. It's not true. And I mean, I could tell you about some of my generational trauma and so on, and we could have a conversation about that. But this is, if you are talking about your ancestry, if your family, if your ancestors were slaves, there is no comparison to that.
True.
There is nothing. So, you know, I want to be very careful as a white person to not try and draw any parallels, because that's going to be just offensive and hurtful.
Very true. Very true. Do you feel that sometimes, especially in your baby steps of learning all of this, that it somewhat feels like walking on eggshells? You have to be so careful what you say, how you say it, and so forth.
Well, one of the people that I meet almost every day when I'm walking is a black man who moved here from Atlanta. And, he's very grateful that he is able to live in Canada and so on, and feels that it is safer here for a black man. Now, we've been, through the COVID, we've been running into each other almost every day and having, you know, first of all, it was just hello. You know, it all starts with that hello and good morning, how are you? And that initial kind of surprise that someone is greeting you, and has progressed as stopping and having like 10 minute chats. And so with him, I feel very comfortable, and we've had some pretty open conversations. But I haven't said to him something that I have said to another friend of mine who I have known for several years. And she's also an American woman. And I said, if I do say something that is offensive, please tell me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Because I don't want to do that.
That's not your intention.
So she said, you know, her response to me was, I trust your heart, Arlene. Even if you do blow it, I still love you.
Great. Great answer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, very gracious.
Yeah.
So step two, avoiding the spiritual bypass. I think I did speak to that, but what I said is, we have to go beyond being just nice or just praying. It is time for us to be advocates for racial equality. So again, I can't just, you know, my morning practice is to start with prayer and meditation and then go for a walk with my dog. And so all I've done is to pray for racial equality. While prayer is very powerful, I really have to be willing to put myself out there and to do something about it.
What would you suggest?
Well, I've written the rest of these points. So those are starting points. And again, myself, I feel like I'm at the very, very beginning. One of the things that I did is I started a book club to study this, and we're working our way through the book White Fragility. And then, you know, the people that are in that group are quite enthusiastic, and you know, we're calling each other out. If somebody says something that is not appropriate or uses a term that is would be considered offensive, we've all agreed that we want to be called out on it. So that's one of our ways.
That's very
a safe
good.
Space, mm-hmm. a safe space for us
okay,
to
yeah.
be able to make the mistakes. So, and that's important because it's all about getting comfortable with the different terminology and knowing what I can say and what I can't say. And we have people who are at varying levels of understanding with the, you know, people that have followed different blogs for several years and people that are brand new at it. And then someone like me that's been kind of following it for a couple of years. And so that's probably the biggest piece that I am personally
step.
Doing right now.
That's an excellent step, Aline.
So educating like ourselves.
Yeah, that's yeah, awesome.
That's huge.
Yeah, definitely.
And because we have a group, there are 8 of us in the group, we hope that we will keep each other accountable to continue the work. Because just like it has happened after every single incident, there's a big uprising, a big amount of interest being covered in the news, and then it dies down.
Right.
You know, we move on to something else. So we don't want that to happen here. We all recognize and agree that this is super important, and we want to see what we can do in our own corner of the planet to make change.
I appreciate that you have this group going. That's a really mm-hmm. good first step for you. You're really living by your article. So that's a good
Thank
step.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you. So step 3, extending love to both sides. I think we talked about that mm-hmm. quite a bit, didn't we? I love this, what Freedom said. If we don't extend love to both sides, we are all in shackles.
Very true.
It was, that yeah. was such a powerful statement. We only gain freedom through the forgiveness of all people. And, of course, this is one of the areas that I do a lot of work in, and is forgiveness. And, you know, I've personally experienced the power of living in forgiveness and not carrying any bad feelings towards any person on the planet. So certainly that, you know, very, very difficult in the situation of George Foreman, where there was one police officer and then I think 4 others were standing there and supporting it. But not only that, there were other people that were there. And you know, it just shows how powerful the fear of the law is in the States that people did not intervene.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was my personal journey of forgiveness, to pray and ask for help to forgive all of the people that were involved in that.
Awesome.
And it's certainly, like I said, that is the hardest step for me. And then step 4, look at where I have inadvertently supported racism by not getting involved. So I'll give you an example. Many years ago, 25 years ago, probably, I was a school principal in a very affluent area in the school district that I was working in. And there was a teacher that had 1 black student in her class. And the father came in and complained that the teacher was not treating the child fairly. Now, I don't remember any of the details of the story. This was not a child that was in trouble, or, you know, those are generally the children that stood out. But in any case, the father felt that the child was not fairly treated. So he said to this teacher, he accused her of racism. And she said to him, "You can't play the race card with me, because I have adopted 2 children from Jamaica." And she showed him their pictures. Then she shared the story with me. Now, that was as far as it went. So by my not exploring the situation further and trying to understand what the father's concern was, by simply accepting that teacher's explanation would prove that she wasn't racist, I've learned, you know, that story has been coming to my mind so much, because one of the things that the book White Fragility talks about is this is a common kind of response from white people. Well, I can't be racist because I have adopted black children. Mm-hmm. I can't be racist. My daughter is married to a black man.
Yes.
Those kinds of comments. But when you really stop to think about it, that doesn't even make any sense.
We could
be racist and be married to a person of a different skin color.
Yes.
And in fact, when I really started to think about it and some of my experience in marriage counseling, some of the meanest comments can come from a partner. So that would have been a personal example of how I inadvertently supported racism by not speaking up, not going deeper into the situation, by not suggesting to that teacher that perhaps we should take this man's concern seriously. Now, if a parent takes the trouble to come in and talk to the teacher, they clearly have a fairly serious concern, because most parents, and this was not a father that came to the school ever. I don't ever remember seeing him there. So it had to be a significant concern on his part in order for him to take the trouble to come in and address it.
Right. Yes.
And we dropped the ball there. So yeah. I'm publicly apologizing.
All of you should have sat down and figured out what this man's issue was and address it. But you've realized that you've dropped the ball. I mean, you can't go back in time now, but it's definitely a lesson learned going forward.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
And, it just thinking about that one situation makes me, once again, I'm humbled because I'm so early in this whole learning curve that I'm in. How many times does a black person encounter those kinds of responses? And, the readings that I'm doing is that kind of treatment, everyone compounds the next one. And the next one,
yes.
And the next one.
Yes.
And then you have an explosion like what we have seen with the protests and so on.
Exactly.
Where people have had enough.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm just kind of having a quick read of what I wrote. This is deep, hard work that we can only pursue if we are willing to go within. So what that means to me is that I need to, first of all, having the book study is kind of like an ongoing therapy session for each of us, in which we have true confessions of when we have done or said something that we regret now, having learned a little bit more about it, or not done or said something. For example, I have an uncle by marriage. I don't know why that's important to me, but it is. And he was very, very racist. He just died a few months ago. He would have been in his 90s, early 90s. So different time, different generation. And my way of handling him was to just walk away. Now, that is not enough. And this, I think, is one of my further points. It comes back to the woman with the black doll. If we just walk away, we're not saying this is not acceptable.
Right.
It's not okay to talk about people that way. But more than that, it's, first of all, practicing love towards this person and not judging him, but being able to say to him, I really love you. And I also love my people of color, no matter where they're from or what color their skin is. And I'm just curious about what that's about for you. Like, what's going on for you when you say that? And what underlies most of those kinds of comments, whether it's regarding racism or whatever that is kind of a mean-spirited comment, it's almost always about us and our fears.
True.
We hear it all the time. And of course, the American news is so much more ever present and I guess more out there, but the fear that people have that we're going to lose something when we have people from different countries, different skin colors moving into our country.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, the Canada that I grew up with will not be, it's not the same for many different reasons, but mm-hmm. people are afraid of change.
Definitely.
That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. Going back to your uncle for a second, I wanted to mention too, based on what you were saying, silent, the fact that you didn't say anything, they have that saying, silent is consent. Silence is consent.
Right.
So it was almost by you not speaking out or saying anything, which you realized after the fact, is that you were agreeing with his statement.
Right. Well, I felt that walking away was making a statement, but now I know
that
I would not do that again.
Right.
I would never do that again. It's interesting. You know, there's another piece to this that is very, very interesting. And an area that I've been really reading about and trying to learn about is we have social contracts. So there's a social contract that says, if I'm a nice person, then I'll be safe. And we have a psychological kind of feeling or desire or instinct, actually, is a better word. We have an instinct to protect ourselves and keep ourselves safe. Mm-hmm. So if I speak out, I'm taking a huge risk. Now, that could mean a whole bunch of things. It could mean that you won't be my friend anymore. It could mean that I'll be kicked out of whatever group I might be in. And in the workplace, it could actually even mean the loss of my job. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm praying that things will change. I do believe that there is a movement afoot and it's gaining strength, that people will recognize that it is not acceptable for people to be racist in any way, shape, or form. That's outwardly racist. Now, the unconscious racism is a lot harder to deal with because we're usually not aware of it ourselves. But when people make racist comments, and if I call them out for it publicly.
Yes.
Now, going back to my uncle, the situation that I'm thinking of was at my niece's wedding. There were probably myself and my husband and my brother and my sister-in-law and maybe my adult children there. In that group, it actually would have been safe for me to call him out because I know those people that were there were not comfortable. Not that I've discussed it with them, which is a whole other issue,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
That I could have had that conversation with each one of those people and said, you know, how do we want to handle Uncle next time, right? This is not okay for Uncle to be going on about this stuff because he was going on quite a bit. And but the area that's most fascinating to me, having worked in a fairly large complex in a school district, that if you challenge the status quo, you can suffer for that, right? So this is an act of courage.
So it's easier to remain silent and fit with the status quo as opposed to going against it.
Well, it is easier, but it's no longer acceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
That silence is no longer acceptable. And the more that people speak out, the more it will become safe for people to be able to speak out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what do you think needs to be done then for us to see a global change?
Well, I think the first step for me that I've been kind of contemplating is to start at home. Always start at home. And what am I doing in my own home? Certainly this is a conversation that my husband and I have regularly, several times a day, really, because it's so much present in my mind and I'm really appreciating what I'm learning and with the books and the blogs and so on that I'm following. So that's the first step, is start at home. And for people who have children in the home, to have those very honest, open conversations with their children about what racism is,
mm-hmm.
Unconscious racism is, as opposed to conscious racism, and that we need to be aware of our own unconscious bias. Then I would say the second step would be to move out. Let's look at our town or our city and what's the makeup. You know, this is something that, again, you know, like, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I've never really thought very much about what is the makeup of our city council? Hmm. And where I live, they're all white. Yes, so if our governing bodies are primarily white and primarily male as well, although the women certainly are becoming more involved, but what can I do to promote and support people of color in my community? So that to me is a very important one. The next level of government is the school board. Again, in the area that I live in, it's all white. So that's not acceptable in this day and age, because we truly are a multicultural society in Canada and in the area that we live in. So that would be an area that I would want to be much more involved in and be supportive of candidates and encouraging candidates of color.
See it be more diversified.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because if the voices are not at the table, and I cannot know what it's like to be a person of color.
Right.
I can read all about it. I can study about it, but I'm not going to be the best advocate for policies and so on that are going to shape what happens in my city and in my area, in my school. So those are two areas. And there is one person in our book study group who is very active politically. So that's an area that she is certainly wanting to help
change.
Make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah. And then to move out and look at our province and then at our country and see how we can support that. But, you know, in my readings, the area that we have the greatest influence is in our own cities. And that's where the policies are felt the most directly. We don't feel our federal policies as powerfully as we do our city policies.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's a really important one. So as far as changing the world, well, that comes after changing our country. I don't think I'm going to be around long enough. But thanks to the internet, you know, just by blogging, and hopefully one day I'll be doing a podcast, I believe that that we can make a difference.
Oh,
our voices can be heard. And we want to encourage our the people that we know that are people of color to speak up, speak out. I was certainly impacted by those people that were speaking out. That was what had the impact on me.
You know, you said people of color to speak up, speak out. We've been speaking up and speaking out for the longest time, but things have been just getting pushed under the rug. So therefore,
yes,
we need our fellow Caucasian brothers and sisters to speak up also. And we're seeing that happen right now. Like you said before, how long that lasts, that's yet to be seen. You're seeing a lot more visible minorities on the ads, on the commercials. You're just seeing everywhere the push of more Black people, of people of color, minorities, whether it be Asians, Indigenous, whatever the case may be. I'm starting to see that more often. I don't know, and I'm not going to say I was blind to it, that, you know, you don't notice it. It's like when you get a new car, if you get a Ram, for example, all of a sudden you start to see Rams everywhere you go. I don't know if
right.
it's because it's in the news right now and it's the main thing. Is that why I'm noticing? But I don't think so. I think when I go on Rogers to look at a phone bill or something, it's a person of color that's on the website now. And I think, to me, I'm just noticing that more and more.
Right. Now, you had said that you had some issues with that.
Yes. I'm glad that it's coming to surface, right? I'm very glad
uh-huh.
that they're looking at, but I also somewhat, it's becoming an overkill, right?
Right.
It's like, okay, we understand that you want to do something about it, and that's great. But it just felt a little bit to me as an overkill, because everywhere I looked, it was just Black Lives Matter, or they've pushed a Black person on the ads, or you're seeing it on the billboard or something like that. I just want it to be natural, but I guess this is the stage it has to go through right now.
Well, and the other thing that I, from the reading that I've done, is we want to be careful of tokenism.
Right.
So I'll just, you know, I have not changed my website at all. It's something I know I need to do. First of all the pictures on it are of me. So,
okay.
You know, and so I want to be thoughtful and careful about what I do and how I do it, and that it be truly, that it be thoughtful, that mm-hmm. it's not done just to check a box.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's a really important part of this is, okay, I went out and I said hi to 10 black people today. So I'm okay, I'm good. It's more about, first of all, getting clear within myself about who I am and how I want to be in this world. And then does my website reflect that?
Right. Well, you might be safer just to leave it with your picture of yourself.
Yeah, I'm still pondering it and how, you know, what I really need to do is have groups of people that are working together at workshops that reflect the diversity of the population in the workshop. Yeah. So once, if we ever get out of COVID, I'll be able to do that.
There you go. That's another issue.
Yeah. But that's sort of what I'm seeing is that people are rushing about and trying to fix something. It's like you slap a Band-Aid on a wound. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you think, okay, we're good. I did my part. I can move on to the next job on the list. And that's definitely not what I want to see happen. And so I'll continue to write blogs. I'm writing one now.
Okay.
That it takes me sometimes a week to write a blog because I do really spend a lot of time thinking about it. But what happened was last week I had a friend who is an RCMP officer who was feeling very defensive about the news stories that are coming up against the RCMP. And once again, I had not read the news stories. So I responded to her in support and said, you know, it's not ever fair to paint a whole group by the actions of a few. And then I went to sleep that night and I thought, oh, no, I just did a white fragility act. You know, I was supporting my friend who was hurting. I love my friend and I want her to not be upset. But I didn't, first of all, I didn't even know what she was talking about. I had not read any of the articles. Secondly, I didn't really try and find out what exactly she was upset about. And she, you know, she's a good friend that I could probably have had. This is all on Facebook, which sometimes can get us into trouble. But, you know, I should have picked the phone up and had a conversation with her and asked her more about it and asked her if she was being defensive, because I think that might have been part of what was going on. So I haven't finished this, but at the end, what will be the end will be, here are the questions that I wished I had asked of my friend. One, how can we know that there is no racism in the RCMP? Have there been any studies done? Where can I find these studies?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
questions.
A much better response.
You're right, right.
Two, so I have to tell you that this was something that woke me up at 2:00 in the morning and I spent the next 2 hours researching it.
Wow.
Number two, what is the process for examining accusations of racism within the RCMP? How can we be sure that there is integrity in the process? Number three, what are the consequences for an officer who is deemed to have acted in a racist way? And number four, what kind of training did the RCMP receive to break down the perceptions of stereotypes and their awareness and the awareness of their own often unconscious racism? So
those are some good questions.
Yeah. So the work goes on, Kathleen, and I intend to continue to pursue it, to learn more for myself, and to share what I learned with others.
That's awesome, Arlene. And I'm so glad that you're here today sharing. I especially appreciate the small steps that you're taking to get where you need to be in your interaction with people of minority.
And thank you.
Yeah, it's great to see that there are people out there that are trying to do something about it in their own way, because there's only so much that we all can. You're doing your little bit, right, in your community, in your area. So
right,
that's important.
Right.
Good on you for that.
Thank you. So, okay, let's talk about step five, stand up and speak out. I spoke about my uncle and how I wish that I had had more courage to speak out and to lovingly challenge him on his comments. And part of step five is that how important it is for us to have the awkward conversations. Because up until this situation with George Floyd, I had never discussed racism with my friends who are people of color. And working in the school district, we had teachers, we had parents, we had children from all kinds, you know, every color from light brown to black. And, you know, even as I say that, I'm not sure that that's an appropriate thing to say. So tell me if it's not. But so we've never openly had these conversations. And it's quite shocking as I say that, because mm-hmm. that would have been a really valuable conversation to have with staff.
Definitely.
To talk about how this is. And and so my friends from, you know, we did have a woman of color that was in our book study, and she dropped out because she just felt like, first of all, she didn't agree with everything in the book. I don't know if you know the book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo.
No.
It's a great starting point for white people to understand a little bit more about racism. But one of the criticisms of the book is that it's written by a white person, and that she's making all kinds of money off of this and very popular on the speaking circuit and so on. And anyhow, so, but that was the first time, our very first meeting with my Indo-Canadian friend was, and I've known her for several years. We've had lots and lots of great conversations about all kinds of different things, but we've never directly talked about racism, you know?
What was her reason? Okay. What was her reason for leaving the group?
Well, one of them was that she didn't agree with the book.
Okay.
Yeah, everything. And then I think she just was feeling overtaxed, overwhelmed okay. with mm-hmm. all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that white people need to understand is that this situation with George Floyd was overwhelming. It was re-traumatizing. And for people of color to talk about this on and on and on is exhausting.
Yes.
I don't know if that was part of her reasoning or not, but it may have been. But the point I'm trying to make is that I was really, really pleased that she originally said that she wanted to be part of the group, because I wanted to have those conversations with her. But now that we've opened that door, she and I will be able to do that in a different venue.
Awesome.
Maybe one-on-one. Mm-hmm. So that to me is a really important piece, is to have the conversations, particularly with our white friends.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And not to expect people of color to carry the weight. Again, as you said, you have been carrying this message for many, many years, and people have not been listening. So now it's our turn.
And we thank you. Children don't grow up learning color. They just see another child. So we definitely know that this is something learnt, that they're learning this behavior to hate from their parents, their surroundings. So they're getting examples, their role models from the people that they live with that are close to them, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And from other children.
Yes, yes.
You know, the life of a child in a school or any large group daycare can be very, very hard, because children can be mean. And yes, you know, children are taught to hate. But, you know, if you have a tough older sibling who is calling you names and being mean, then you learn that, and then you take that into the schoolyard. And any child that is different is going to be picked on.
Definitely, yes.
For whatever the difference is, you know, we had one child in the school that was a very, very financially privileged, but in many ways impoverished school. And there was a child that moved into the school who had thick, thick, cold Coke bottle glasses. And that poor kid, you know. And again, those are the ones that I always want to put my arm around and just spend some extra time with, because I know life is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So, you know, you know, some schools are predominantly Indo-Canadian in the area that I work in, and then some schools are still predominantly white. So if you're the odd child of color, odd is not a good word there, but if you're the only child of color in a classroom, you stand out. And so you will be picked on in some way.
Yes. Listening to you talk about the child, because I did experience that growing up as a child in England. We are where we are today. I've learned from those things. I've seen change happen. The change has been slow, but it's coming. And I believe the next generation or so, because the generation here, they're not really for racism. They're the ones that seem to be standing up for this change more so.
Right. Right. Yes. And I think we still have a long way to go. Like, I was listening, I should have written his name down. I was listening to a talk by a Canadian man who was from Toronto, and I understand Toronto has a much, much bigger problem with overt racism, yes, at least than we do on the West Coast. But this man was here giving a presentation, and he was stopped a couple of times in Vancouver and asked for his ID, which surprised me. I didn't know that happened, but according to him, it did. So it's, the problem is not solved. We still have a ways to go here.
Yes.
Okay, step six, support businesses owned by people of color. So just being aware of how important it is, and you know, living in a small community, I'm in White Rock, which, you know, the joke used to be it's called White Rock because it's white, the population. That's changing. Mm. And, you know, some people have struggled with that. Some of the white people that I've heard of have, you know, like some people moved to White Rock because it was white. You know, welcome to modern day Canada. And, you know, I mean, when I look at the businesses that are around here, and I walk everywhere. I don't like to get in the car and have to go anywhere, but I would have to look really hard to find a business that was owned by a person of color, except for the restaurants.
Yes, true.
Right. So we have many wonderful ethnic restaurants, which we have always, always patronized, not because they're run by people of color, but because we love the food. But I think it's just a really important thing to be aware of. Are there businesses in your area where there are people of color, and get to know them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Spend some time talking to them and learning a little bit about their experience. And, you know, people are so fascinating. And if you come from, you know, you're from England, so if we had more time, I'd want to know more about that and about your experience that you felt that you faced more racism in England than you have here in Canada. So I find I'm a people person. I want to know about where you've come from and what your experience has been. And I just find it all very fascinating.
It can be, yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
You know, so my friend that I've met down here on my walks from Atlanta, you know, we've had some great conversations. And the one thing he said he really loved about Atlanta is that it's primarily Black. So there is comfort in sameness,
right,
for all of us, right?
Yes.
And whereas here, he's usually the only Black person that I see on my walk. So I don't know how that is for him, but I can't speak to that. But
right.
I know from traveling that sometimes it's kind of natural to gravitate to the people that have a similar background that you have, or come from the same country or whatever, share similar experiences. Mm-hmm.
I know you talk about traveling. I know when we travel from Vancouver to Toronto, as you step foot off the plane and you're walking in the airport, you see the difference right away. It's like, yes, I definitely know where I am in Toronto. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we moved to BC and we found our church, we were really excited that our church was very mixed, very multicultural, you know. But however, we know, and our church at the time when we joined, the ratio was about 80% Caucasian, 20% Black. And what I'd noticed over the years, that has changed, and the Caucasian people are leaving. Why would that be?
Well, I mean, I can't answer that with any kind of authority. I don't know why. I'm wondering if your question is, are you asking, are they leaving for racist reasons?
I'm wondering. I don't know. You get that very polite smile and the nod of the head, and no one's ever rude or disrespectful to you. but a few weeks, few months down the road, they're no longer there. And I'm just wondering, and I don't see these individuals to find out exactly why. And people aren't going to tell you the real reason why they leave in the first place, you know? So, but
no, well, if it's for racist reasons, they're not.
Definitely. I mean, I didn't mean to put you on the hot seat on that, but I don't know. It's a question that I've always had. I don't know who's going to be able to give me that answer, but, you know, I don't want to assume. I was so looking forward to the mixing, the mix of cultures together.
Well, we have a long ways to go in this country. I believe we're only beginning to understand how institutional racism is so predominant, and how we've been brought up into a certain way of living and thinking, and the power base is mostly white. And whenever there's a shift, you know, I'll speak to the schools, because that is something I know about. That when in Surrey, where I was a school principal, we have this white south, which is where White Rock is, and then we have the predominantly brown north. And North Surrey would be a mix of people, but some of the schools are almost completely Indo-Canadian. And what happened in those neighborhoods is that the white people, once the Indo-Canadians started to buy homes in those neighborhoods, the white people started to move out because they were uncomfortable with that. So that does happen. It does happen. There's no sense pretending it doesn't, and it happens in Canada. And, you know, I'll just tell you a little story about what I tried to do. So my husband and I live in Mexico for 6 months of the year. And so in that country, we are foreigners, and they have, that's what we're called. The Spanish word for foreigners is extranjeros. So we're extranjeros. That's what they call us. Mm-hmm. And at first I was really hurt by that, because I didn't want to be thought of as an outsider, but I am, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to speak the truth. I want you to, to not see me as different. I work real hard at trying to learn Spanish, and I want to be able to speak with my Mexican neighbors and so on. So we live in a townhouse complex. We're not right on the ocean, but this is a townhouse complex, and probably in general 50% of the people living there are white Canadians and Americans, and the other 50% are Mexican. So I was asked to, I mean, nobody ever wants to be on the council for the condo association. Mm-hmm. So I was asked to be the secretary, and I agreed, and no one else offered their name up. So I was voted in, but the Mexicans, they'd never had, and there was another man who was American man, white American, who was voted in as treasurer. The Mexicans had never had white people on the board.
Oh, wow.
And it was 2 months of hell as we went through different processes, meeting with lawyers and conversations and so on. And eventually the Mexicans called another meeting and voted the white people off.
Really? Wow.
Really?
Wow.
So racism is, you know, it was a powerful lesson for me, and I was very hurt by it. I understood because people are threatened by change.
True.
That's
yes.
the truth.
Yes. Yes.
That is the truth about human nature. So the way that there's so much work to be done, and this is the beginning, Kathleen. I applaud you for opening the conversation up. This is what we need to do.
Yes.
We need to have these conversations in our schools.
Yes.
We need to have these conversations in our churches. We need to have these conversations with our city council.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because unless we bring it to the surface, people are operating from a subconscious level, from a place of fear, and they're not even aware.
Exactly. And what are they fearing? So, I mean, we need to spend time with each other, get to know the person. I think spending a time with a person, you'll get to know the person, and you'll get to realize, hey, this is a good person. I have nothing to fear.
Yes, that's right. But part of that is getting past the, I mean, there's so much, we could have another conversation.
Yes, we could. Sure.
There, to really get past that, white people have got to get past the notion that white is best.
Definitely.
It's not only white people, because, you know, but again, well, this is a book that my Indo-Canadian friend recommended to me a couple of years ago. It's a book called Brown, and it talks about, I mean, that's just the title, Brown. Mm-hmm. Within the brown community, that there is this feeling that white is best. Yeah. So we as an entire culture need to really, really challenge that. Like, that is something that's being passed down through the generations, that this idea of white superiority. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if I really believe that, what does that mean? So if I am leaving the church because there are many brown people coming into the church, what is it about having a large number of brown people in a church that makes me feel threatened? Do I really truly believe that white is better? And if I do, then I at least be honest about it.
You're very right. There is a lot of work to be done. And this is what we need to do. Have these conversations, as you've said, and be open and just hear what each other has to say. And then even share what our fears may be, you know, as to the color of the skin or the insecurities or the fears that we may be feeling, the different issues that are in front of us.
Exactly. That's right. If I'm feeling, you know, you just said the word insecurity. If I'm truly secure within myself, then I can't be threatened.
Exactly. Yes.
So that's where the work needs to be done. What do I need to do within myself? And which brings us back to faith.
Exactly.
Because if I now as a member of a church, that's why I'm there, because at least I hope that's why I'm there, is to build my faith and to be in community with other people of faith. So if I truly, truly am anchored in my faith, and I know that I am loved and I am precious and I am beautiful, then that is what I project out into the world. And that is how I see everyone else.
Exactly. Yes. Nelson Mandela said it well when he said, "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes mm-hmm. more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." I thought that was quite powerful. And true.
Absolutely.
True. Very true.
Absolutely.
Very
yes.
true.
So this brings us to step 7, which is creating greater opportunities for people of color. Now, in my background as a school principal working in Surrey, the difference between the schools that were in the South End, which were primarily white population, and the schools that were in the North End, which were primarily brown and with some children, with also some black children. So the difference in those schools was remarkable because the resources simply weren't there. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the parents in the South End were primarily professional parents. They had means and they had connections and they pushed to get what they wanted for their children. And if the school didn't have it, then the parents were able to pay for it to make sure. So for example, in the area of technology, the South End schools were always very well provided for. Now, I've been out of the school system for 8 years, so hopefully things have changed, but I highly doubt it. Schools are very political, and in politics, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So that to me is a huge disadvantage. And so that's an area we could certainly be doing better, at least in this part of Canada. And I'm going to guess that is likely true in other parts of Canada as well.
Yeah, I would agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we look at greater opportunities, of course, we want to start with education. And then we also want to look at job opportunities. And in the United States for a time. They don't anymore, but they did have affirmative action, which was about providing opportunities for well-qualified candidates of color. And it was a very political move, and it was very controversial, and eventually it just kind of died in the water. Now, the affirmative action was not about providing a leg up for people of color. It was really about providing equal opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I don't think we've ever had affirmative action in Canada, and I don't believe that any organization that I've ever been involved in, at least, actively sought to promote people of color. And that's really what this seventh step is about. Now, you and I spoke a little earlier about the political system in Canada and in BC. And one of the things that I remember making a statement that here in White Rock, our city council is pretty much white. And that's not what's supposed to be what White Rock is all about. So I believe that we can certainly seek out and promote and encourage people to put their name forward to we need all voices at the table.
Definitely, especially if we have to represent, because it's no good a Caucasian person trying to represent myself, because they would definitely not understand the issues that we face.
And well, the best that I could do if I was on city council is to be talking to people like you, to be reading as much research as I could do, and so on.
Yes.
But if you're at the table, Kathleen, you're going to know firsthand exactly
yes.
what needs to happen
yes.
and what needs to happen in your city or in your province or in your country in order to have those to be represented and to have the issues and concerns addressed.
Exactly. So the next step, I think, is for us to get people like myself to go on these committees. And, you know, earlier on, you and I were looking, trying to find an MP. They had Indigenous, they had South Asians, but there was no Black representative. And definitely that shows me that we do have our work cut out for us, and we do need to step up and take these roles and realize that they are qualified for these roles and that they can do them.
Absolutely. And I think it starts by saying, we want you there.
Right.
It takes the invitation and the encouragement from the white people, whether it be business, whether it be in education, whether it be in politics, to say your voice matters. And we want you here.
Exactly. And make you feel welcome, because you're coming in already as a minority, but then that struggle to try and, you know, do your job, but then the resistance you might face. So you need to come into an environment that you feel welcome to the table.
That's right.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. That was awesome information that you provided today, Arlene. And I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to talk with us about your seven steps to ending racism.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Kathleen. It's just been a delight. And once again, I'm just at the beginning of my journey of understanding and learning and changing how I do my life. And I hope to be able to continue to be a voice for all people.
Yes. Thank you again for sharing. We appreciate you. Have yourself an awesome rest of the evening. Take care and bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoy the topic and found something that you can apply to your own life. Don't forget to share this episode with your family and friends. And remember, live well daily.